Welcome to episode 187 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith. This is part two of our interview with John Maloney from MIT and John McIntosh, the primary author of the squeak port to the iPhone, iPad environment. And this week you'll hear more about the issues John ran into with that port with Apple and how things are progressing, as well as some more news from John Maloney about the Scratch environment. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group of Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning. Now, even though the contractual the part of the SDK agreement that you violated would be the interpreted piece, so it goes back to the original contract. If I remember the timeline, this happened around the time or right after the time that they changed the terms, pretty much to make sure the Flash couldn't work on these things.
Yeah, so this happened the week after they changed the terms, and so the computer science community and developers are all quite upset. Well, I'm not sure the computer science community yet, but the developers are quite upset.
There are a few rules in there that you're kind of having trouble with here. I've got a friend who makes a Commodore 64 emulator, and he can't put that on the iPhone, but he saw somebody the Commodore 64 emulator with certain Commodore 64 discs bundled in into the store. So one of the rules is your program isn't allowed to download and execute stuff.
Yes.
So it has to be self-contained. So yes. You can't. So one of the ways around that was to combine the image with the VM. But technically, downloading people's Scratch things is downloading a program and running it in a virtual machine. And they've got another rule that says that your program can't be in a virtual machine at all. And then they've got this new rule about the language that has to be written in. So there are three rules that just sort of fly in the face of what you're doing.
I don't believe the virtual machine rule is there. That was in an earlier version of the contract, but that's been removed.
Oh, okay. They replaced it with the new one.
But they not allowed to download and execute code. That's the rule that we ran afoul of, right, John?
Yes. And so, Apple did talk to me about, if you don't do that, then maybe things are okay.
Well, actually, before you go on to that, because this is the same problem that the Flash had. Flash would download Flash executables and run them.
Oh, yeah.
Their solution to that problem was, let's just take the Flash thing and compile it for the iPhone. So in theory, you could do the same for Scratch, which is to take somebody's project and compile it for the iPhone and put it in the App Store. And that'd be a lot of work for some 15-year-old kid to go through to get their thing on the iPhone. But now this new rule means that you can't do that either.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Right, so even if you manage to work your way around the downloadable content part, you're still running into the problem of the originally written in part. And, even stepping back from the originally written, the downloadable content, the reason that one runs kind of weird to me is that if you look at the kinds of things that are happening on console systems, to move away from the iPad, if you look at console systems like the Xbox and the Wii and the PS3, most of the games out there for these things are just filled with downloadable content. You buy the game, or if you're on a PC, you're using Steam. And a lot of the game pieces are downloadable content that you either get from the vendor or from the larger community, right?
Yeah.
And that's really what Scratch is all about, is the larger community contributing pieces that you might think are cool.
So we did look at, and certainly there was discussion about bundling Scratch with like 1,000 projects. But I think, this gets away from their share mandate. Because in reality, if you were to go buy the app, it's very unlikely that you would find a project that you had created in our choice of 1,000 projects, given that there's a million in the store.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exact. Kids would want the main reason that you would want this app is so that you could download your own Scratch project and then show it to your friends on your iPhone or your iPod Touch. And if you couldn't do that, I think it really would be sort of it wouldn't be a very exciting app for most kids.
This whole thing gets really stupidly bizarre when you look at the exception to the rule, which is JavaScript. So you've got a phone that can now run HTML5, JavaScript soon will be able to render 3D graphics with the Canvas 3D, can now do 2D graphics with Canvas 2D. You know, where's this arbitrary line of it's okay to run JavaScript on your phone versus it's... Are they worried that somehow the application will exploit the device? I don't know.
So I had a concern about, you know, where Apple was going with this, and I wrote this letter, and then I sent a note to Steve Jobs on the 14th, and later that night he responded to me, asked some questions. So then I entered into a new plateau with the young people around my household. So,
he had an email from Steve Jobs. That's something.
Yes.
Dad, suddenly cool.
An email that was more than one word, too.
Yeah, it was more than one word, actually. The interesting thing was that it didn't say yes and it didn't say no. So, from my viewpoint, you know, Apple is still thinking about what to do here. This then led to, I posted it to the Apple Developer Forums, which is a closed paid service. And then I got a call from the New York Times and then from Wired Magazine. And then that kicked off this Wired article that you've probably all read.
Right, I linked to that
last
one,
week. Yes.
And there's also a New York Times blog article.
Yeah, the Gadget blog. I stumbled across that one as well.
Yes, and so, and actually, there was an interesting article that the dean of the University of Cambridge wrote yesterday, for example, talking about how computers have become appliances, and young people today have no interest in learning how they work or how to program them, and the issue with Apple. You know, restricting what you can do with the devices. You know, I think here, I think the majority of the people in the room here are older and probably can remember that at some point in their lives they sat down and in front of some mini computer or personal computer, but no one put a legal document in front of them and said, here are the rules about what you can do to write programs.
No, I remember
actually
the, PC,
the first few games that I wrote.
I remember getting PCs you could boot straight into BASIC, and the old Apple II that I had way back when you could execute peaks and pokes and start getting pixels to light up and not light up.
Yeah,
the first programs that I wrote, I borrowed a book from the school library and copied line by line the program into BASIC until I understood what it did, and it worked. I mean, right now you'd say, okay, well, that's plagiarism, copyright violation, so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, and as an example, one of the reasons the Commodore 64 machine originally was rejected from the App Store was because you could bring up the BASIC console and type in a BASIC program.
Really? That's why it was rejected, because it was fully emulating the whole thing, including the BASIC console.
Yeah, it was a Commodore 64 machine, so the fact you could write a BASIC program meant it was in violation. And, I mean, it's really the same rule that applies to Scratch, although we don't allow people to do programming.
Actually, I have an app on there that's SIDPlay, and it downloads SID files, which in all fairness is the assembly code for controlling the SID chip on the Commodore 64. So technically those SID players are in violation, but I suspect somebody's made the argument that it's well understood and there's no way you can abuse it. But
I don't
knows
think
for
so.
Sure.
I think they haven't been caught yet.
Yeah, maybe that's the case. You know, there has been a bit of, the developer community is obviously up in arms about this. We're all pretty upset about it. You know, Rubyists, Pythonists, Perlists, Lispers, Smalltalkers, we're all being told, get lost.
Well, not just that. I mean, never mind all the dynamic languages you just mentioned. Keep in mind that as much as on the Smalltalk podcast we like to disrespect Java, I mean, there are a ton of Java programmers on the planet, and they've all been told to go fish as well.
Yeah, well, what's I found interesting is that because of this negative step, people are, I think you blogged about this, James, people are starting to believe in all kinds of things from about Apple now. For example, someone was suggesting that there would be an app store for macOS X 10.7 and that you would need to get Apple's permission to put your app on that and, you know, basically be locked down like the iPhone and the iPad. Steve Jobs replied with no. But the point is that, you know, a month before this happened, no one would conceive of that sort of move coming from Apple. But now we're all sort of looking at Apple with a fairly skeptical eye as to what it is they think they're going to do in the future with this hardware they've produced. And who is their competition going to be? You know, is Google Android actually going to come out with something like the iPad that's good? That's the real question. Is it going to be good?
And now a short break for David Buck's Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbaron Design Minute. You've just spent a few hours tracing down an obscure bug, only to find that it was a problem in the base code provided to you by the vendor. You override the code to make the fix and publish it. Everything works finally. The next step is one developers often miss. You should inform the vendor of the problem and the solution. They have the ability to include that solution or another solution in a future release of the product. If you keep the fix to yourself, the community won't benefit from your efforts, and you'll be doomed to port it to every new release that comes out from the vendor. It helps to give the vendor some feedback. This has been the Cimbaron Design Minute. Cimbaron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbaron.com or email info@cimbaron.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
Well, actually, that kicks off a question I wanted to ask both you, John McIntosh, and John Maloney, and that is, do you guys have a level of confidence that you might be able to work this out with Apple, or do you think that you're going to have to go to targeting, if you want to target mobile devices, are you thinking now that you're going to have to target something like Android or some other small device?
I guess as far as Squeak is concerned, I don't know how we can currently target the iPod unless Apple changes their policies and, you know, allows us to use something else. We've looked at trying to implement Scratch in HTML5 and JavaScript, and at least currently I don't think JavaScript is quite up to the task, especially because of Scratch uses a lot of audio. I mean, you can play sound files. You can make, you know, MIDI like instruments play notes and drum sounds and stuff. And none of that is really part of the HTML5 spec. Maybe a little bit of playing entire audio files, but not fine grain control. So I think we're at least until Apple changes their policies, we're sort of stuck as far as the iPad is concerned, which is a shame. Because it's just a beautiful platform. It would be just a wonderful platform for Scratch with, you know, dragging and dropping the blocks with your fingertip and everything. So I have to say that we're thinking much more seriously about working on the Android platform and looking at that as our sort of target development platform for exploring touchscreen versions of Scratch.
And, you know, this is kind of tragic in a way, because if you look back in time into the early 80s when the Mac first shipped, you know, it was so far ahead of where any other machine was, but Apple went down the same kind of restrictive, make sure you can only color within the lines path, and eventually Windows, which at the time certainly all of us agreed was not as good, ended up overtaking it. And I suspect that if Apple continues down this path with the iPad and the iPhone, that eventually Android will overtake it for pretty much the same set of reasons.
I totally agree. In fact, I think it's really important for the Mac platform in general. Mac OS X, the only reason that those machines succeeded was because when they came out, and even now, they're on top of a BSD Unix system with an open library, well-documented, free programming languages and tools. Without that stuff, it never would have got anywhere. It would have just been yet another Mac in a line of stuff that doesn't work with anything else. And that's been a big success, but the new platforms that Apple's coming out with are not OS X. They're iPhone OS, and it's a whole different beast. And I suspect that's going to be the case, and Apple's probably okay with that.
Well, you know, looking back, the Newton was kind of like that. Originally with the Newton, you were only supposed to be able to program it in Newton script. And I think eventually they relaxed that a little bit. But, of course, the Newton wasn't a success. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe there is a lesson there. On the other hand, I will say that I think that I don't see the Mac OS going the same direction. I think the iPhone and the iPad are really sort of media consumption devices. They're sort of aimed at, you know, viewing the internet, viewing videos, viewing your photo album, listening to music. They're not really media creation devices. They're not even like, you know, kind of, although I'm sure they will, you know, people will use the iPad as a word processor. I don't think that's what its kind of design was. And maybe there is room for both of those things. I would just say, though, that it's a shame. It's such a beautiful piece of hardware. It's a shame that, you know, there can't be a version of the iPad that is, you know, open to all kinds of different programming languages, especially languages that would be accessible, you know, to kids and to beginners.
Now, this is kind of a speculative question, but it's kind of the way I look at this is that it seems to me that most of this was generated for whatever reason on Apple's desire to not have Flash be a competing development platform for the iPhone and the iPod and the iPad. They wanted to make sure that if you were building for these platforms, you were using their set of tools. And things like Smalltalk and Scratch and Python, Perl, Ruby, Java, .NET with the Mono project that was targeting these things. These are all collateral damage. And I kind of wonder whether Apple even gave any thought to what the collateral damage was. I mean, I get the impression that they were a little surprised by just how much blowback there was. I mean, the blowback hasn't been huge. Certainly, it hasn't affected sales or anything. But there's been more blowback, I think, than they expected.
Yeah, I think so. You know, John mentioned this point about, you know, is the iPad a consumer device or a creativity device? But I think there is a lot of creativity going on. You know, there's that brushes program which lets people paint on the device. There's various apps now that you know, you basically have virtual keyboards of musical instruments or imaginary musical instruments to create soundtracks and music and share with. I did talk to Alan Kay last night and was told, you know, Apple is still thinking about what the right thing to do here is. And I think that gets back to your issue of that we're collateral damage. And I don't know if they've really thought about, from a computer science, computer education viewpoint, the impact of what the legal side, the lawyers are doing to that community. And so, you know, I take heart in the fact that Steve didn't come back and say no, which, you know, he is famous for doing.
Right. I mean, I kind of got the impression, based on the way this played out, at least keep in mind that obviously I'm neither a lawyer nor am I involved in how these things are playing out. But from the kind of lens eye view I get of this by looking at the blogosphere and the goings on, it seems to me that Apple's lawyers were trying to figure out how can we target Flash without looking like we're targeting Flash. and it kind of, you know, from what you're saying now about how they haven't given you an absolute no, I don't think that the powers that be at Apple completely understood that they were whacking everything else upside the head.
Well, that's my thought. You know, but certainly from our legal viewpoint, of course, the answer is no, because that's the only official answer that we've received at this point. So going forward, we're just basically waiting to see, now that Adobe has said they're not going to do Flash, that we're going to see what happens. Now, regarding the Android, you know, Andreas Raab did port squeak to that platform a couple of months ago, but he found it difficult, and the port is actually kind of more of a work in progress, and it's not usable. And so when, you know, people of his caliber find the going rough, I'm not sure that I think it's going to be a while before you, you know, see.
Now, is this rough in the sense that the port you had at ESOG 2008 was rough because it wasn't that far along? Or is it rough in the sense that things are really rough going because it's not really ready for what you want to be able to do with it?
I think it's like you have to tap the screen in order to get it to refresh.
Okay, so it's rough based on what you want to do with it.
So it's, I think it's really rough from the viewpoint of the behavior of the way that Squeak wants to work with the user interface does not map at all to the Java VM, the way that it presents.
Oh, that's right. So on that platform, you're supposed to write in Java, correct?
And so, you know, someone has to, with a lot more knowledge, has to come up and figure out how to be really clever to shoehorn the Squeak VM into the environment. And then people, I have seen things where people claim that Google is really, you know, focused on Java as the platform here, and if you want to work in other languages or environments, there's really no support for you.
See, now that's an interesting thing, because Google, in other respects, not on the Android platform, I guess, but in other respects, they're very high in things like Python.
Yeah, well, they have Python. The guy who makes Python works for them.
Yes, and so actually, you know, for the Google Code of Summer, they're, you know, giving the Squeak, Faro, Smalltalk community, I think, 5 or 6 student projects.
Right, I just blogged about that. Yeah, so they're kind of, Google, I almost get the impression that Google has, I mean, you often hear the phrase said that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. With Google, I think maybe you have to imagine 10 or 20 arms, and not a one of them has any clue what the others are up to.
Yes, and so, you know, actually, Michael Ruger and I have been working on a game for the iPad as of late, but he has done an app with, I guess, the Find a Bike project in Germany. There is an app there for the German railway system to help you locate a free bike that's provided by the railway system, so you can, it'll tell you where it is at the train station, you grab it, use it, put it back, and then, you know, say what the lock password is, and of course it knows where you dropped it off. He ported that over to the Android, and of course was telling me, you know, you think that these touch devices are the same, but they're actually from, even from a user interface viewpoint, very different. The users who use them have different expectations and behaviors and gestures. So things that you might find in an iPad version of Scratch would not have kind of the same behavior. You may have to do things a bit different on an Android version.
So you would have to tailor it to that device.
Well, one thing I noticed was the gestures on these other devices, these non-Apple devices, gestures are kind of faked. You know, when you start waving your hand around the screen, it sort of detects a macro movement and does a stiff action, perhaps with an animation. It seems so much more fluid on the Apple devices. And that's one of the things that concerns me about, you know, Google Android iPad competitor, is that it just might not be up to the same caliber.
And now a short break for this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Mumbai, India. Pathfinder Consulting is looking for an analyst, Unix, to fill a team leadership position. They are looking for someone who has a wide variety of experience, including Smalltalk, and Gemstone DBA familiarity. The job listed in this report is just one example of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs, or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
Yeah, that's true. Apple really, you know, the iPhone just works beautifully. That sort of the way it tracks your finger when you're scrolling around is it, maybe it's partly because they've got hardware support to help them, but it just really works well. I suspect Google will catch up eventually. I mean, Apple has at least a 3-year head start on this stuff.
So, you know, the outcome of that is basically for a small group of developers, you know, wanting to build an app for both platforms, it becomes a lot harder.
Right, because of the way they're restricting you, saying thou shalt have to write in this language over here and that language over there.
And then the behaviors are different, so abstractly you can't just have an app that is going to behave the same on both platforms.
Right, well, now this raises there's a side question I wanted to ask about the iPod and the iPhone and the iPad, and that is that there's sort of the guerrilla community, if you will, around the iPhone and I guess now the iPad. I don't know. There's not a jailbroken iPad yet, is there?
Yeah, there is.
Is there? Okay, so there's so my information's even out of date, but there's this guerrilla community around the jailbroken iPhones and iPads where you have alternative stores. I mean, there's, if I recall the name of it, it's the Cydia store, where people who've jailbroken their devices can buy non-Apple-approved applications through some alternative set of stores. Now, I'm just curious, is that a direction that you guys are at all interested in going down if you had to, or are you pretty much committed to either going with Apple if they they relent, or not doing it at all?
I would say we'd be, the Scratch team would be sort of reluctant, just because I think there just wouldn't be enough users. We go after users that are, you know, sort of just learning programming and stuff like that. And those are not necessarily, you know, the hacker types who would be willing to jailbreak their phone and void their warranty and all of that.
So you don't want to have to tell them, here are the 25,000 easy steps you have to take before you can use our stuff.
Yeah, right. Before you can use Scratch, which is really easy to use, you know, jailbreak your phone.
So, and you won't be able to make phone calls anymore, but that, you don't need to do that anyway,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly. So that's the problem, I think, with that. I think we would rather be able to run legitimately on, you know, whatever platforms we made Scratch work on.
Okay, well, let me go back to John McIntosh again for this question. Then, obviously, you're not going to be able to tell me any details, and I don't want to pull them out of you. But do you have a sense as to whether this is going in a positive direction right now, a negative direction, or you just don't know?
I've been told it's going in a positive direction, but it really does hinge on what Steve Jobs wants to do.
So you think it's all the way up at his level? This is not being handled by a bunch of people down at some, you know, I don't know, 5 line managers, 4 levels down. This is all the way up at Steve Jobs' level.
Well, if you feel that Steve is responsible for setting direction in terms of that he didn't want Java or Flash on the phone, then yeah, that's the level you're at.
It could be that Steve sort of hamstrung himself, where he wants to let this sort of stuff run on his phone and his iPad, but if he turns around and makes an exception, then the lawsuit from Adobe comes rolling in immediately.
Well, you could conceivably come up with some educational only kind of exclusion that Scratch could squeak through, I think.
It's just messy. So, you know, I think the people in the education field would like to have a clean solution, so that they don't, you know, I've had some people, a company in France, for example, who they run computer summer camps, and they actually build their own software. And so they were wanting to build a variant of Scratch, for example. And so, you know, those people would, of course, like to have a clarity that if they went ahead and put their engineering time into building an interpretive language that you could work with on an iPad, that Apple's going to accept it.
I wonder how many applications have been rejected in the last month or so from these rules and the stricter tightening of the belt. And, you know, it could be quite telling to find out how many people put in the effort to build an application in favorite language X, only to now have it basically be kicked out.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if anybody except Apple would know the answer to that.
I rather suspect that that's the kind of information that Apple would not make public.
Yeah, as far as I know, no one has been rejected with regard to the new license. It's from what the people in the bloggers say and other people say.
Well, that hasn't got into effect until iPhone 4 is actually out in the wild, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So the proverbial shit hits the fan when the new phone comes out.
Well, yeah, I think what will happen here is, you know, hopefully they're thinking about and reflecting on that. There's a lot of people that are caught as collateral damage and changing, putting those phrases in, and maybe they'll take them out.
Right, because the OS 4 isn't out yet, and the phone that would be that OS 4 is made for isn't out yet, and neither is the iPad. At least, you know, they haven't released it for iPad yet, and that's scheduled, I think, for the fall. They've got breathing space, is what I mean. They theoretically, now I don't know that Apple will. Apple's not like this, really, but if they thought that it was better, they still have time to back off.
Yes, because they are probably a few months away from actually having to enforce that particular clause.
Okay. So the bottom line, though, is that based on the question I asked a little while ago, you feel perhaps guardedly optimistic that things are potentially moving in a positive direction. Scratch might actually find its way back onto these devices, which would be a good thing for everybody, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, actually, I had a question for John there, whether or not they saw any uptick in users that signed up or traffic last week.
Oh, we did. We definitely saw a big uptick in traffic, like around 15 minutes after that New York Times blog post hit. There was I hadn't seen the Times article yet, and I got an email from the guy who sort of watches. He's a graduate student in the group, actually, who created and sort of monitors the Scratch website. And he said, "I think we're getting a denial of service attack. We're just getting tons of traffic." And then, like 15 minutes later, you know, we saw the New York Times blog article, and was like, "Oh, that explains it." But he had actually, by that time, he had added something that was, you know, logging IP addresses to see if there was some pattern. They were all coming from a, you know, small number of machines or something.
So this proves that no publicity is bad publicity, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, to be honest, actually, this whole business has probably been good publicity for Scratch, because I think some people have been made aware of the existence of Scratch who had never heard of it before. Maybe quite a few people have been made aware of it, and of course, it works fine on many other platforms, and so that's probably good. Like you guys, we're not a commercial, you know, venture, so we don't have an advertising budget, so we really rely on, you know, word of mouth and, you know, the occasional sort of news articles to spread the word about Scratch.
I'm sorry, you're talking to the advertising channel for Syncom Smalltalk, so.
Yeah. You're doing the advertising right now, in fact.
I can advertise too while we're at it. I'll just mention that, you know, Scratch is available as a free download from scratch.mit.edu.
There, well, that's good. That's actually a question I was going to make sure I asked before we wrapped up. But
actually, the full URL is scratch.mit.edu. Is
that correct? That's correct. And actually, in the U.S. at least, if you Google for Scratch, that's usually the first link you get, which is very, very handy.
Yeah, I just tried that before we went on the podcast, and it was the first hit I got.
Yeah.
And maybe we should have a podcast on how to achieve being the number one hit for such a common word. But
I totally don't understand how we managed to do that. I think having .edu in your domain name is helpful, but there's many sites about, you know, Scratch DJing, And I don't know how Scratch the programming language manages to get ahead of all of those.
Well,
but I'm happy about it.
Maybe you have some friends at Google.
We can go into the same conversation as to how I managed to be the first hit on James Robertson, unless there's been a case going in front of Judge James Robertson on the FISA court, you know. unless he's in the news, I'm usually number one on my own name. But
John, maybe you want to talk about Scratch 2.0, because I think you guys have a grant application in for that.
Yeah, we have. We've applied for a MacArthur grant, and we're in the sort of the finalists. So there were, I forget how many applications, but I think there are we're down to something like 90 finalists. In that proposal, we talk about doing a new version of Scratch, and this will be implemented in some kind of a language that runs directly in your web browser. And actually, we were considering HTML5 JavaScript, but I think we're going to go with Flash instead, just because it's a little more mature and supports audio and stuff like that. And so we are actually actively working on that, and that would sort of come out in probably a year, or maybe a little more than a year, and as I said, probably be implemented in Flash. Although we're always open to changing our mind about that if a better technology comes along.
There's some irony there.
Yeah, actually, but there's just FYI, there HTML5 in theory is meant to be able to support the kind of audio you want to do, but I don't expect that to be the reality for a year or two. But there are libraries that you can get in JavaScript that use a small Flash plugin. Basically, just put that Flash up in a tiny one-pixel spot hidden off the side of the screen, make calls to it from the JavaScript to do the audio. So if that's potentially one way you
can... Yeah, and I do understand about that trick. So that's why we are still definitely considering that that path. The main reason to do that is that currently, in order to sort of look at the program inside a Scratch project, you have to download the Scratch program, and you've got to download the project, and that's a lot of steps before you can actually look at the code. And since one of our goals is to get people to become, you know, sort of better computational thinkers, to think of programming as something that, you know, is easy to read and write programs. So if they can do that directly in their browser without having to download anything, that would be better. And so that's the direction we're going with Scratch 2.0, along with some other things like we'd like to be able to integrate more with social networking sites and also make use of more data from the web. So sort of more interconnectivity, more web-based type projects.
Funny, you can scratch that Facebook itch.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Yep.
Facebook, yeah, I know all about that stuff.
Things like that.
Yeah. Actually, wanted to also ask this question. Right now, with the Scratch that exists, what platforms can you get Scratch for?
You can get it for Mac OS, Windows, and Ubuntu Linux. And it also runs on the EXO, which is actually Fedora Linux underneath. So I guess that's four platforms. And then until recently, I could have said you can get a Scratch player that works on the iPhone, but I can't say that anymore.
And the iPad.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. But as John said, the news on that is not necessarily all bad going forward. We're still waiting to hear how that game plays out.
Yeah, and I did want to say one thing, which is that, you know, we sort of did this player version on the iPhone and the iPod Touch because the screen is very small. But I think, you know, John and I and, you know, are much more excited about the idea of having a full Scratch authoring environment that worked on the iPad. So, you know, if Apple's policies would allow that, I think that would be, you know, that would be fabulous.
Actually, it's been a niggling thing in the back of my mind this entire time, having looked at Scratch again, playing with it for a bit. I realized that I had seen something like this recently that wasn't this. And it just dawned on me, it was while I was at Legoland playing with the Lego Mindstorm programming language. It's basically you stack little puzzle pieces on top of each other to make the robot programs.
Yes, that's right. And actually, our group, the Lifeline Kindergarten, works very closely with some groups at LEGO. So it's not completely an accident that there's some similarities. There's also other groups that work with LEGO, in particular National Instruments. So there's some similarities between this thing called LabVIEW from National Instruments and the LEGO robotics programming language as well. But anyway, yeah, not coincidence. And hopefully we'll see some of the LEGO robotics stuff looking even more like Scratch in the future, if we have our way.
that would be pretty neat to have a true 4G programming language across platforms, across paradigms.
that would be neat, yeah.
I think it would be ironic to build a time machine, travel into the future 200 years, open up Excel and click on a cell and have little Lego pieces pop out for you to program your Excel thingy. It could be an ironic future where people can barely write, read, do arithmetic, and they plug Lego blocks together to make their computer do stuff.
Now, to know where Michael's coming from, the future he's envisioning here is like the one in Fallout 3.
I was thinking more like in Idiocracy.
Less different than you might think. So, all right. Well, I think this is we've been going for a little over an hour now, so I think this has been a really great conversation. I wanted to thank both you, John McIntosh, and you, John Maloney, for taking the time to come on with us.
Well, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on.
The topic in question is a complex one, so it's great to be able to talk about it.
Yeah. Thank you very much, guys. I'm glad you came on.
Sure thing.
Well, thank you.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Now a short interlude for this week's Squeak News with Randall Schwartz.
This is Randall Schwartz here with your latest Squeak News. You can find all this news and more at news.squeak.org. For the past 18 years, the European Smalltalk User Group, also known as ESUG, has organized the International Smalltalk Conference, a lively forum on cutting-edge software technologies that attract people from both academia and industry for a whole week. The attendees are both engineers using Smalltalk in business and students and teachers using Smalltalk both for research and didactic purposes. This year's conference will be held at the City Lab Cornelia in Cornelia, Barcelona, on the 13th to 17th of September. As in previous years, this year's edition of the largest European Smalltalk event will include the regular Smalltalk Developers Conference with renowned invited speakers and a Smalltalk camp that provides fruitful for interactions and discussions. This year we'll also see the 6th Annual Innovation Technology Awards, where prizes will be awarded to authors of best pieces of Smalltalk-related projects, an international workshop on Smalltalk and dynamic languages, and for the first time, there'll be a business day on Thursday, the 16th September, with a focus on agile development processes and Smalltalk. ESUG is sponsoring 10 free entrance tickets. To get a free ticket, you should send a mail to the ESUG board, that's board@esug.org, with a subject of ESUG 2010 free entrance plus your name, with a small statement putting your case. Note that students can get free registration and hosting if they enroll into the Student Volunteers Program. You can support the ESUG conference in many different ways. Sponsor the conference. New sponsoring packages are described at the ESUG.org website. Submit a talk, a software, or a paper to one of the events. Attend the conference. We'd like to beat the previous record of attendance, 156 participants at Brest and 170 people at Amsterdam. This year, we're also looking for your experience in using Smalltalk. In addition, we're looking for tutorials. The list of topics includes, but is not limited to, the following: XP practices, development tools, experience reports, model-driven development, web development, team management, meta-modeling, security, new libraries and frameworks, educational material, embedded systems and robotics, SOA and web services, interaction with other programming languages. Submissions are due on the 1st of July. Notification of acceptance is on the 15th of July. More information, again, at the ESUG.org website. We're also proud to announce the 6th Innovation Technology Awards. The top three teams with the most innovative software will receive respectively 500 euros, 300 euros, and 200 euros during an award ceremony at the conference. Developers of any Smalltalk-based software are welcome to compete. This year, you are asked to provide a 3 to 5 minute video explaining your entry. More information can be found, again, at the ESUG.org website. If you're a student wanting to attend ESUG, have you considered being a student volunteer? Student volunteers help keep the conference running smoothly. In return, they have free accommodations while still having most of the free time to enjoy the conference. More information at the website. For Squeak Weekly News, this is Randall Schwartz. You can also check out my Smalltalk-related blog at methodsandmessages.vox.com.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretation podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.
The app tester was checking out my
right, we sort of have to live with this little window of vulnerability, because the alternative would be to have, you know, an army of people just examining all these projects as they came in, you know, 1,000 projects a day. You know, it'd probably take 2 or 3 people. I don't know, more than that. I don't know. It would be kind of a nightmare. So rather than trying to filter stuff before it goes up, we let stuff go up, and then there's a button that says, you know, flag is inappropriate, and if somebody, you know, sort of sees something that upsets them, then they click that. But it doesn't end there, because then that only just is a signal for us to review the project, because what sometimes happens is that people will flag things that, you know, that they think are inappropriate but really aren't, or they'll just do it to annoy their friends, or quote unquote friends.
Yeah, they're being a bully, cyberbullying.
Cyberbullying, yeah. You know, like other kids in their class or whatever, they'll all gang up and, you know, flag their projects. So we have to undo those flags. And you know, it's weird, like it's a little bit like Wikipedia, because we see some of the, you know, sort of dialogues between people with very different viewpoints. So, for example, creationists might post projects, you know, about creationism, and then other people get mad and might post projects, or flag those projects and say, you know, they can't post projects about creationism because it's wrong. It's scientifically wrong. And then other, you know, the creationists will flag the projects about evolution. And, you know, we basically sort of try to allow, kind of any political or, you know, or kind of religious viewpoint, as long as it doesn't, you know, as long as it's not offensive to other, or so, not, I guess offensive to other people. It could be offensive to other people, but as long as it doesn't.
As long as you're not nailing the cat to the wall.
Yeah, what kind of things do you actually censor out then? What sort of things have been, you know, rejected?
Oh, well, you know, projects that have, you know, sort of, we sort of allow a certain amount of cartoon violence, but projects that get really violent, we'll censor those. Projects that are disrespectful to other people, especially ones that, you know, call out somebody by name. You know, we've had projects where kids will say, you know, so-and-so is an idiot, you know, and they say that by making a scratch project that says that. And, you know, we say, no, that's disrespectful. We don't allow that kind of disrespectful stuff. Very, very occasionally we've actually had, you know, some sort of disturbing projects, like, you know, one with like a swastika and kind of a, neo-Nazi sentiments and stuff like that. Fortunately, those don't come up very often. It's I guess the something that comes up very often, and it's kind of accidental, is kids will put in soundtracks of songs that they like that just happen to have like bad language in them.
17 plus soundtrack.
Do you beep them out or do you just reject them?
No, we have to reject them or sometimes ask people to, you know, to just take a portion of the song that doesn't have any bad language, or to find an alternate song. I mean, it makes us feel a little bit bad because, you know, this is the kind of stuff that people hear on the radio all the time. So why don't we allow it on the Scratch website? But, we do try to avoid, sort of bad language and stuff. And it's mostly because we don't want parents to say, oh, you know, that Scratch website is full of filthy stuff. You know, you know, I'm going to block it. You can't go to the Scratch website.
I understand that.
Have you had many students or people make projects that push the Scratch viewer beyond its capabilities so you get severe frame loss or anything like that?
Yeah, sometimes. Scratch is not terrifically efficient. And occasionally people will do projects on a fast machine that a slower machine can't keep up with. And, you know, and it just kind of degrades. We don't have any real, you know, advice other than, you know, try to make your images smaller or do less animation. You know, when people come to us and say, it's not playing well on this other computer, or, you know, the not very helpful, get a faster computer.
Well, the certainly on the iPhone, it's slow. I don't remember. We look, John has a benchmark of frames per second.
Apple solved that problem for you. That's what they were doing.
Yeah.
Well, it was noticeably slower. I don't remember the numbers. But it was not a problem with down in the virtual machine side. I actually opened a ticket with Apple's engineering with their bitmap graphics expert and worked from the point of where the virtual machine gives the bitmap over to the iPhone operating system to render it to the display. So we worked all that and made all the delay in there disappear. It kind of gets turned over to the GPU in the phone, which is really quite fast. There was some other stuff with sound. Some of the projects, like there's a gap of silence or something. But as far as I could determine...
Latency before the sound starts playing?
No, it's like a gap in the middle of it or something, or when they restart the track or something. But I kind of determined it was not a... It didn't seem to be a problem with the Smalltalk code getting the sound data. It seemed to be, you know, whatever they were doing on the Scratch side, they weren't feeding they weren't restarting the soundtrack or something.
Yeah, that's... It's one thing is that a slower machine can sort of reveal inefficiencies that you sort of didn't notice when it was running on a MacBook Pro or something. I'm not surprised that a few things like that sort of cropped up. So according to my thing, it looks like you, Michael, should have gotten the entire file.
It's actually, Skype says 1 minute left on the transmission.
Yeah, I have a minute.
Oh,
or
1 minute
left.
Here. Okay.
So,
actually, yours, John Maloney, is actually, I've got that one.
Yeah, it's mine is 1 or 2 minutes
1 minute,
left.
And then Michael's has got more because he's sending me two files. But
yeah, I'm sending my track plus the combined track that went out live.
Yep.
Right. So mine is only 36 megabytes. It said 108, but that was because it was sending 36 megabytes to three different people.
Right.
So I wonder if, I hope it recorded okay. You might want to.
What does it say it is here? It's 37.8.
That sounds about right. And my track is 43, and the combined track is 63.
Yeah, mine was 51.
And actually, you were recording at 22.1, right?
Me? In this case,
I was going to, but I actually wasn't. It turned out Audacity wouldn't let me set it to that. I was recording at 44.
I had 44 too.
Okay.
Like I've said before, if any of the audio's got problems, Michael and I both have backup, so there's sure. There's no chance that it'll be lost.
It just sounds a little bit. It doesn't sound quite as good as when it's mixed together.
Right. When I've got three or four independent tracks, what I can do is the points in the podcast where people were talking over each other, I can fix that and make it sound like we weren't actually being a bunch of people who couldn't figure it out.
Yeah. Okay.
So, James, how much sleep do you need to be a corporate shill tomorrow?
He needs actually a little sleep, I think. It's useful if you have just... Because you can sleep better.
It depends on just how much brown nosing you plan to do.
Oh, yes.
So I think with that, I think I will let the voice chat go, and I'm going to thank you guys for coming on again.